So I'm joking, but I got in last night from Hawaii at 1:30, and then the bridge was closed and the BART wasn't running, and I took a cab through San Mateo for $150, and I got home at 2:30 and haven't slept too much. So that's the first one. So if I fall asleep up here, someone wake me up. Second, we have graded your exams. The TAs should be assembling them and doing all that stuff this morning, and we're going to try to pass them at the end of class. Is that right, Aaron? Okay. I guess overall they were about what I expected. Some of you did better than I expected. Some of you did worse than I expected. The exam roughly goes, there were 55 questions worth 10 points each. We gave 1 point to anybody that answered the question that the fewest people answered. That sort of crowdsourcing, that it must be difficult, right? So if you answered the difficult question, you got a bonus point. We didn't deduct if you answered the easiest question, because that would have been unfair, but that meant that technically you could have got 51. The grades of the exam range from about 25 to 49. So it's a huge spread, what I sort of expected, and I'm not quite sure how we're going to break this up, but roughly speaking, I suspect that about 47 and up is an A+, about 42-ish or something is an A, 37 is probably an A-, 30-something is probably a... I'll send that out. And I will want to talk to some of you, especially those who did really better than I expected, and those who did worse than I expected. I'm going to talk to all of you particularly. But again, it was a useful exam for me. So we will be publishing an exam key of sorts, which we basically took a couple of answers that we thought were really good answers from your exam, and we're going to put out a summary that you can use to compare your exams with. Now, if your exam question shows up, that means you did a great job in that question. If it doesn't show up, doesn't mean you didn't do a great job. You only just picked one or two. So, just to give a sense of that. So, look at your exams. Look at the sample questions. Compare them to your answers. If you think that you did a good answer and you didn't get credit for it, come talk to me. It's possible that one of my three TAs who graded the questions, plus my two that I graded, made a mistake, and I'd be happy to reconsider that if you think this really is a mistaken grade. Okay. I spent some time this weekend looking at the results of the midterm survey and thought a lot about it. I think there were four findings in the survey. One is that you think there's too much reading in this class, and there probably is. It's hard when I try to update the syllabus every year to make sure I have exactly the right stuff, and I try to make it better every year. There are things that people don't like, but we need to do a better job of focusing what's really important. And so starting next time, because today's sort of a makeup lecture where we doubled the reading because it was the only one we had the review session for, starting next time, I'm going to try to have much more focused reading, saying read these pages more than anything else. So each of the TAs will be assigned one of the lectures, and they'll be, their job will be to whittle it down to the bare essentials, so that should reduce your reading load. You don't like Spinones. Some of you do, but most of you talk trash about that woman, and it really hurts me. But still, I have a good positive. I'm going to react positive to all these suggestions, so you'll see that I have a proposal that will deal with our disconnect about the value of Spinonius. You think there should be more review, and I think there should be more review. So I'm going to start as a practice. Every lecture, stopping 5 minutes before the end of the semester, before the end of the lecture, and going back to the 5 or 6 most important slides of that day. So you'll know what they are, and you want to think about it. You come back that day, you'll see what I thought was important. And you want more hands-on. People love the IO lab, I know that. I don't think we can put the IO lab into 202, because that's why it's an IO lab separate from 202. But I have an interesting idea. And I've already talked to some of you about this. I'm going to have a seminar next semester. It's going to be one of these 296 ones that's kind of like, experimental, new, maybe one of a time. It's going to be called The Intellectual Foundations of Information Organization. A title you may recognize. It's the title of the Spinonius book, right? But that's what this course is about. And so what my proposal is to invite maybe 10 people, 5 in this class and 5 in in the second year class to help me overhaul the first half of this course, which I think is the part that people have the most variation in view of. And the goal of that seminar will be basically to take a hard look at the first half of CO2 with one of the goals of getting rid of Svenonius. But the way we get rid of Svenonius is not to dump the material, but it's to rewrite Svenonius. And so I think the idea would be if we get 10 people who are passionate about this course and getting rid of Svenonius, I'm sure there's plenty of you in that class, in that set, to essentially each write some section of Svenonius, some topic of Svenonius, which is important, but essentially 202-ize it. So write it with some of the blog posts and the news posts that we've all been writing about, and get that into the body of the chapter that we're having. And also to take some of the 202 hands-on, IO2, a lot kind of things, and maybe put a little, you know, example of that illustrates that kind of thing. So I've already talked to Nick and Ryan, and I want to have them work with us on that. Because they won't be teaching the IO lab next semester, but this way I can get them to kind of contribute some of their lessons learned from the IO lab that goes into 202. So if this idea appeals to you, and I hope it appeals to some of you, it will be a pretty interesting seminar because it won't really meet on a regular basis. It'll maybe meet every other week. I hope to have like writing teams, but there'll be one lead and maybe a second or third person who helps us, the writing team, to sort of take these sections on. And we'll write about authority control and the abstracts and hierarchy and ontology and things that are core to this class but which you're not happy with the readings for. So we'll just write it ourselves. And maybe it'll be a book in a year. You know, the iSchool book on 202. Because I think that it's clear that people are not happy with Svenonius, but the stuff is fundamental. That's why it's called Intellectual Foundations of Information Organization. So I hope I can encourage some of you to do this sort of one-unit seminar, or whatever this will be. So, you know, it's basically, you're going to write a term paper, which will be your contribution to dumping Svenonius. If you want to put it that bluntly. I look at it as bringing Svenonius up to the high standards of this class in its contemporary context. Okay, so I'm not going to finish this lecture. This lecture, I basically took the two lectures I gave last year in this area, and I tried to bolt them together and then throw out things which are absolutely inessential. But the reason there were two lectures was because I thought this was pretty important. Not only have one lecture to give it, I'm going to have a lot of this material. I've actually asked the TAs to teach. So this today's TA section will be a lot of more of looking at examples of search user interfaces to get it, make sure you have a good handle of all these different issues involved in the core aspects of query specification, results, and reformulation, the key three things that we're going to talk about today. So, are there any questions about any of this? So, again, I will publish some kind of course. I notice you're not even in the middle of registering now, but this class is going to be, you know, something, an odd time. It won't conflict very much. It'll be easy to have an hour sometime that meets, because it really won't meet on a regular basis. It's really going to be more of a directed writing and directed research thing with a bunch of little teams that we work together with. The idea being, we'll rewrite Svenonius for the 21st century. And I know some people have already been doing that this semester with the blog post and the news post. So in some sense, you'll own some corner of Svenonius and rewrite it. And I think there really could be like the iSchool textbook here out of this after a while. Okay. So today I'm going to talk about the classical model of search and how that results in the classical model of user interfaces for information retrieval. And we'll contrast that with web-based search, which is where most of where the action is these days, for the obvious reason. And I'll focus on best practices for query specification, results, and formulation, which are the three main things that we need to be concerned with. Did you like the Hirst book? I think it's really going to be the definitive treatment for a while because she is the expert here. And that used to be one chapter in another book. And I said, Marty, you cannot give me a 160-page chapter to assign to my students in 202. And it kept getting bigger and bigger. And so finally she said, I'm just going to write a book on it. And I said, make chapter one the summary chapter. I can assign that in 202. So that's what she did. So chapter one is kind of a nice summary of it all, but it's not sufficient for 202. We need to have more nuance about some of the other stuff. So I'm recommending there's like five chapters that will earn our syllabus. If you're all interested in this topic, that's going to be the book to own. It'll be a nice compliment if you also own the Raghavan book as well, the more computer science I am. Those two books are going to be pretty important together, I think, as a collection. But there is no 202 book.
There is no book on the first half of this course, absolutely, unless we write it ourselves. Okay. So what are you looking for when you're trying to do information retrieval? You're typically doing one of many different things. You might be looking for a citation for a document. You want to know more about where some document's grounded in the literature. You may have some specific question, what is the capital of California? You may want to be doing some comparison, try to learn something about some related items. You may be trying to just browse and familiarize yourself with some area. We may be trying to discover new knowledge by looking at some topic from a number of different perspectives. When that's done by people, we call it discovery. When it's done by machines, we call it data mining. Essentially to say, let me discover connections that we didn't know before between two bodies of literature, two information sources. That idea of making connections, and that, again, that's a much fuzzier research and information retrieval problem than saying what's the capital of California, which I think is still Sacramento. Until the state breaks into two or three pieces because of the DOA budget disaster. Okay. There are a lot of people who try to design user interface IR systems, and like many of you have probably done it or will do it in your careers. It's hard because everything seems to be a special case in some sense, because everything is so tied by how it fits with every other feature of an IR system. Some people start with these kind of general goals for usability in information retrieval systems. This is the classic list that people often refer to. Your interface should be consistent, it should provide shortcuts, it should get feedback, it should let you kind of have closure so you can tell when your task is done, it should have error handling, it should let you reverse, undo things, it should support your ability to be in control, blah, 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 blah. I mean, it's hard to argue with this kind of list, but it's also not very prescriptive. It doesn't tell you what to do in any particular situation. And that is really one of the design challenges. They're too broad to lead to specific design recommendations most of the time, because you can often have a situation where they're in conflict. So there's a tremendous amount of experimental work in this field. You can go to the SIGCHI conference and see, you know, papers like about these things. You can go to a number of other conferences and find lots of papers about usability of this and that. Many of them seem totally trivial because they're looking at some very small feature in some very, very precise context. But that's because small details really matter. So that's kind of the problem here, that the literature looks like this gigantic sea of trivial things, but it's because every little thing can matter. And that's why I think Marty Hirst has done such a service to the field by trying to write some kind of synthetic treatment of it all, because that hasn't existed at all. Up until now, we've really seen just chapters in IR books saying, well, there's this issue about the interface, and now we have a book about the UI, which I think will be a real contribution. Okay. Well, let's start with the classical IR system. This is where information retrieval started with professional, just as we've talked about professional metadata makers, we had professional metadata users. We had probably 40 years ago, we started to have the emergence, when we started thinking that computers could do more than crunch numbers, they could actually crunch text. What an insight. Gee, the text and numbers are just the same thing to the machine. Let's start having these large, specialized bibliographic collections in scientific research, in legal cases, in news, and so on. And the users of those systems were people like the ones that were trained in this room, essentially professional reference librarians. In fact, a large number of them were trained in this room. You're sort of in the middle of the ghost of this era. And these systems, because they were built in essentially a mainframe computer context, they were using the system architecture and technology of the day, you know, dumb glass teletype or even a teletype talking to us to a mainframe computer, no local processing, so on. So they're using no bitmap terminal, right? Not a character-based display. You basically have user interfaces which are command lines. And this is the era in which you have the research by people like Furness and those guys in the vocabulary problem paper where they're saying, what should the vocabulary of command languages be? You know, to say copy or move or compare. I mean, what should those verbs be like in these kinds of command-driven systems? As a result, you had these very cryptic, powerful command languages that would be used to carry out information retrieval. And a really good example of the one is one I have here, where I have a string where the query is, well, I'm not going to read it, but what it really is saying is, this reference librarian is looking for a query that want to find documents about essentially cancer and DNA sequencing. The polymerase reaction is a brilliant idea that basically says, how do we split the two parts of a DNA strand and then so we can replicate it. And so this is looking at research involving DNA sequencing and cancer. So you see these different ways of talking about that. You see a lot of W's, meaning that the terms have to be with each other, kind of adjacent to each other. You see some parentheses to show grouping. It's really cryptic. Well, you also see some question marks to mean stemming, meaning things that start with that string and so on. So this is a very cryptic kind of thing. And this kind of interface evolved for a good reason, which was that you had expensive computer resources, and you had you literally paid for the search. I mean, I remember having a budget when I was at Bell Laboratory, which was it was a very wealthy company. We still had this notion of a budget. You go to the library and you talk to the reference librarian, and that person would then run queries, and you get something charged against some account someplace with the queries you ran against the mainframe. And so you want to think very hard about your research question, and you would then go to the intermediary who would, you know, do the incantation as the high priestess of IR and then come back with some result set. And so your goal was to sort of get it all in one very precise query, because going back, when you went to the end of the line and you had to sort of, you know, again, had that kind of iteration through a person as the intermediary rather than you at the machine itself. So this assumes a processing model that essentially says that you go with a fixed information need, you find the magic incantation with the system to issue the query, you get some results, you evaluate it, and then you say, well, did I get what I wanted? If not, then I sort of reformulate and go back again in this fairly coarse cycle. Again, over time, that cycle got smaller, and you could have command languages, which would let you essentially iterate the query in the command language, which was a really big step forward. But that just meant you had even a more complicated command language, and so you started getting things like this, where now this is a sequence of queries to the great Oracle, bibliographic computer. Well, here we're saying, I want to learn about biometric security techniques, and I want to look in the most informative parts of the metadata, and I'd like it to be the titles and the lead paragraphs. That's what the PI and the LP means. So I'm going to find things that start with biometric and security, and there's these two parts of the document I'm likely to have more precise results. So we're doing a structure-based query. We're using the structure of the document type, which we have to know in advance what the parts are going to be. And we learned that there are 1,621 hits on biometric and 40,000 on security, which is too much. Okay? Individually, as a set, there's 678 of those that match both biometric and security. That's still too many, so we want to say, well, why don't we take that set, which we now see is labeled S1, and join that query with looking for CS equals Harvard and Medical. I'm going to see articles where the corporate source is Harvard Medical School or Harvard Medical something. That comes back with 52, which seems much more reasonable. So then I want to print these out according to a format number 3. So you see where it says I'm going to potentially list set 2. Using format 3, so this is going to say, I want to use a particular metadata selection. I want to only show the certain parts of these things, and format 3 is a specification of some amount of the metadata of those sources. You know, so I get a report which has 10 at a time where I've chosen how much metadata to display. So I'm controlling the output specification in terms of what's going to come up in the results. I mean, think about that relative to what happens when you search something in a web engine. You don't specify the format of the output. You don't specify any of these things. It just happens kind of in a blur. And that's the challenge. Because the challenge is, of course, that you would never use these if you were an untrained person. You wouldn't get to the machine. You'd have to go through the intermediary because that person was the one who was trained to do this. And that the source that you were searching at the time were basically very specialized sources where you really want to get high recall. You want to get all the information which is relevant to your query because you may only get one or two tries. You really want to make sure you're not going to go back over and over and over. You're going to get one or two tries, and that'll be your research to get the literature as when you're starting your research, your literature review and kind of analysis and so on. You start with one of these things and then you'll be done. You will have gone to the oracle and you've gotten your results. So that kind of interface, again, is very highly shaped by the nature of the resources and by the and it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. The technology is expensive to use, it's hard to use, so we only have these specialized people use it. And so they're going to learn. You'll take a course on using Lexis. Okay, you'll take a course on how to use one of these applications. And again, it'll be a course in this building. You'll take a course on how to learn to do one of these command languages. It really will be that kind of thing. Yeah. I think ordinary people would go to the public library, maybe with not that particular question, but with questions. They say, I want to learn more about some topic. I'm doing a term paper and I need some help with this. And you'd go talk to the librarian. And that person would then do this magic and they'd hand you a printout with 20 sources. And you'd then spend a week in the library finding them. Because what you'd found was the citation, not the source. You'd found the pointer to it and you'd have to kind of rummage around the stacks in your library. I mean, doing research for a term paper, I mean, I know you can't remember these days, but I recall when I was, say, in high school, or your professor would, or teacher would say, you must have at least 10 sources, and you're going, oh my God, where am I going to find 10 sources? Okay? Because it would be work to find those 10 sources. You'd find one book and it would point to some other books. You'd say, well, I've got to find that book now and stuff. And it was, I mean, Tony's nodding his head, right? It was like, because you couldn't just get an infinite number of sources by typing one keyword into Google or Bing or something. Finding the information that you needed to think about, to consider, was a major, major thing. You'd spend weeks in the library getting started on a research project because you had to find the stuff to start thinking about. Yeah, so I mean that's why public libraries, I'd say in the 50s and 60s, kind of that high watermark of public libraries was the case where the public librarian, the reference librarian, was a really important person to all the kids in high school and all the college kids, because you went to that person and say, I need to get into this, give me access to this sort of magical body of the world's knowledge, and I need someone to help me be my guide. You couldn't do it yourself. And there was no expectation. That's why you went to the library, because you had this highly trained and highly respected person who was going to be the gatekeeper for you. Does that conform with your...
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, in college and everything, when I first graduated, there was a lot of that. And you know, very difficult
to find resources. And it's just hard for you all to imagine, right? So the... I mean, those of you who are like 20-ish... Okay, which is most of you. So you recall, I'm 2 times Ayush plus 10. Right? Okay. That sounds very biblical, doesn't it? 2 Ayush plus 10. Alright. I'm probably 2 some of you plus 15. I don't know. Alright, anyway. Okay, so you can make progress. And one way to make progress is to take some of these, you know, now you're using, instead of using a printer, clack, 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 you can now use a PC as the client talking to the mainframe. And now you have this, or the web browser, and I have a webified version of that command language. Doesn't look that much different, right? Here you are specifying what the query is going to be. And here's you specifying which source you're going to look for.
Again, it's very complicated because the domain is complicated and it's a very specialized information resource. It isn't clear that it adds much in usability, but for the people who do this for a living, they probably thought it was a huge step forward because they have to remember things. Now they can sort of just recognize the boxes to check off rather than saying, well, is that format 3 or format 4 kind of thing. And of course, this continues to improve because there's real business value here. Lexus is a real franchise for Westlaw. And here you see a pretty recent version of the interface. Still complicated because the problem is inherently complicated. This here we are trying to find a court case and we're trying to pick which of the federal circuits we want to search in. You know, I've got to try to track down precedents in a particular circuit because I'm in that, and that's where my jurisdiction is. I got to make sure I only look for cases there because those are the only ones that are relevant. Judge won't accept them on those in other circuits. They may not be relevant to the case. So you want to be able to precisely search which of the federal circuits do we have to go in. We all know that we're in the Ninth Circuit here, right, in California. Okay? Okay. Now, this changes radically with the web. Because, first of all, the size and scope of the web is so much larger than any classic bibliographic collection. And in addition, you expect to find things about almost any topic rather than just, I want to find all the cases in which cite so-and-so case in this circuit over this narrowly defined legal topic. Now it's going to be anything. And people have also gotten lazy. If you remember back to our discussion back in the dark annals of history about lecture 2 or 3, when we talked about information forging and that kind of economic model, return on investment model of how we, where should we put our scarce scavenging effort to find information resources? Well, now all of a sudden, going to the library seems like a waste of time because you can just sit down and bang away at this at the web search and get more than you could possibly use. And expect to have it delivered to you, the entire document, not just the pointer to it. The idea of having to go get it somehow is like, what? Walk to the library to pick up this document? You must be joking, right? I mean, again, this old folks just cannot imagine that this stuff actually comes to you. It really is. I mean, there's a concept of interlibrary loan. Have any of you ever heard of that concept? You go to the library and you say, there's this book I want to read. It isn't in this library, but the librarian can submit a request, maybe by calling or by faxing, because they're going to really make this thing fast, to some other library in some other part of the country, and this book will come in the mail 10 days later, which you now have as a resource. It better be worth it, because you spent 10 days getting it, right? Tony?
Back in the day, they actually had a bus service.
Any more old guy stories, Dan?
I still use interlibrary loan. The Oakland Library system is really good for that. But there's, for example, there's a translation of Fairy Queen that is not exactly rare, but not only has it, it's not digitized. And you need to ship it from somewhere.
I mean, imagine you have to actually find the book and have to go get it or have to have it brought to you. Imagine that. So, I mean, it's a very different world. And as a result, you now have this, which you could say, democratization of information retrieval, where instead of having the priest or the priestess be the only one who can go and talk to the oracle, anyone can try to find things, and they can do it on the web. But that means that the user interface that will be used to accommodate that function has got to be able to handle people who are different in every possible way. They're different in their cultural background, they're different in life experience, they're different in their reading ability, their intellectual ability, their biases and how they look for things, how they organize information. And of course, if you have this wide diversity of content, you cannot specialize in an interface like this one, where you have very specific support for the that knows about and exploits the nature of the collection. I want to search in this narrow set of document types rather than in everything that's been tossed into the index. That's going to make a big difference in terms of what kind of functionality you can put in the user interface
And it kind of becomes a least common denominator issue where you say, well, what is it that everybody could probably figure out how to use? Type into a box one or more words. All right? That's all you have that the kind of we can basically make everyone able to use. And of course, that's even made more complicated by the fact that I want to use our iPhones or our Droids or our Blackberries or whatever it is that you're going to use now as your primary access device to this world of information. You want to be able to do it on that device as well. And now you have problems of limited capability or limited screen size and some limited interaction repertoire. And so you don't have a lot of choices anymore, and you end up having search UI, meaning type into the box. And sure enough, the default user interface for most search engines is type into the box. So this is Google. As of last week when I went and updated my screenshots, it still asks you if you're feeling lucky. I bet most people have no clue what that means, but you know, you type it and you only get one, and maybe people think that's good to get one. Assuming that you think that Google really is all-knowing. This is Microsoft Bing's default search. I actually like this because it's got cool pictures. They change the background every single day. It's a box on a picture, and that means that it's kind of more, I don't know, less threatening perhaps than this, which is kind of, you know, stark and minimalist, right? This is the Ask default search. This was a very big search engine a long time ago that kind of racing to the bottom, but it still has a lot of nice capabilities. They tried very hard for a long time to say that they had, you could type natural language questions. They used to call it Ask Jeeves. It's actually founded in Emeryville by one of our former PhD students here. And they had an image of this like butler guy, like Jeeves in the British movies, and you say, Jeeves, find out what the capital of California is. Yes, sir. He comes back and says, it's Sacramento, sir. Right? I mean, that kind of interface they were trying to convey, that you had this smart agent that would come back and take your natural language questions. Yes?
I talked to someone who works there at one of the career fairs here. It sounds like they're actually moving back in that direction.
So they were here as a career fair?
Yeah.
How cool is that? They still love us. That's good. Okay. Did you take a job from them? You're going to go interview with them?
Not yet.
Anyone interviewing with Ask Jeeves? Okay. Is that because of you or because of them? It better be because of you. Okay. Yahoo has a default, which is slightly different because Yahoo still is in the business not of primarily delivering search queries, but search results, but delivering content as a destination. So the web search is in the context of all the other resources which they want to organize for you. Yes?
Initially, Yahoo was
Yes, do you know what Yahoo stood for? What Yahoo, the name Yahoo comes from?
Yet another hierarchical organized
oracle or something like that. The idea was that Yahoo would organize these websites for you. They hired librarians, they called them ontologists, which was not what they really were, but they called them ontologists. And the idea was, I mean, in 1992 or 3, I mean, you wanted to be in the web, you would write some email to the guys in Illinois who were building the first directory, the guys who were going to build Mosaic, the first graphical browser, and say, please let people know that my website's up. And they sent out mail announcing saying, there's a new website up. Isn't it great? Berkeley has a website now. And you literally would, and then people would go and they'd build a little hierarchy. They'd say, we should put it in the organization of all websites. And that works pretty good for the first 1,000 or 2,000 or 10,000, and at some point it stops scaling. And that's when Yahoo starts becoming more and more of a search engine rather than a directory service. And it's interesting to go look. If you've ever used the Internet Archive, the Wayback Machine, anyone use the Wayback Machine? Let me talk about that later this semester. But you go back and you look at Yahoo over time, and you see the sort of transformation where homepage goes from being the directory to being. And now, directory's probably on this somewhere.
But it's not very apparent where it is. It's still out there somewhere. They didn't throw it away, but it's certainly not as prominent as it used to be. And as you saw, if you read the Hirsch chapters, when you try to bring this kind of capability to the masses, again, you are the chosen people. Okay? You're the ones who are going to be able to do all these things because you've studied all these great ideas and so on. And most people don't get this stuff. It's too hard. They look at this box and they go, what do I do? And so they learn a little bit about the web. They hear on the TV show, type www blah 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 and get, you know, the special offer, right? Or learn more about that. Go to this URL, the URL. Go to the URL and, you know, do this. And so some people never type URLs. Some people type sort of URL style when they type into query forms, where they basically mash everything together with no space. They think it should be like a URL with no space, so they'll type, you know, instead of saying query, school of information, Berkeley, which you might type as a query, they'll type one big word, squirrel of information, Berkeley, with no spaces, and then they'll not find anything. So I guess they don't have a website anymore. Yes?
The second highest search keyword is www.girlscoutsnorcal.org. So people type www.girlscoutsnorcal.org into Google.
Into the search box on the side of that site.
Yes.
That's pretty good. That's a good example of this, right? That people they don't have a good sense of what they're actually doing. Only 1 in 6 uses quotes in query forms, and most of them do that wrong. They have no notion that that when you do that, you are basically doing a phrase, which is a good thing if that's what you want. If it's not what you want, then you're going to find a very small number of hits, probably. And they don't appreciate the vocabulary problem, which means that when they type something that doesn't work, they go, there must not be anything here. And you have chosen one of the low-frequency aliases, and yet they believe it must be that the web doesn't have anything about their topic. And we all know the web has something about everything, because in fact, that's a game. There actually is, believe it or not, a company, and I forget the name of it, I read about it on the airplane, whose business model is looking at query logs, figuring out what queries are about to be asked because they haven't been asked yet, sort of doing pattern analysis on queries and saying, gee, someone's going to ask a question about how to make your dog take a bath. Okay? Because that's never been asked before, but people are asking about other kinds of taking bath pets, and they haven't asked that one yet, so this one's imminent. They'll then say, someone should go out and write a 1-paragraph story about that, or a 10-second video for YouTube, and publish it, so that when that query gets asked, you're first in line.
But that's also registering on the media this weekend.
It's what?
On the NPR show, on the media?
Yes. Please post the link to that. Thank you. But so the idea is that if it has been asked, someone's figuring out why it hasn't yet been, and they're going to write something which will be the first in line when that question gets asked. It's really, because people ask everything. Now, people have real trouble with Boolean operators, which is the simplest, least powerful, but easiest to implement, which is why we'll talk about it first this week. But of course, Boolean semantics are counterintuitive. Those of you taking 206 know this. Those of you who never will take it because you're out there in the unwashed masses think that give me everything you know about Sacramento and everything you know about Schwarzenegger. So give me Sacramento and Schwarzenegger. That's actually less than if you ask separate queries for Schwarzenegger and Sacramento. But most people don't. They think "and" in the kind of inclusive way, when in fact logically it's a request for less information. Likewise, "or" they get that backwards. Okay. They don't understand the notion of a stop word, where we take out frequent words Because if you say, if you take out words like the occurs in every sentence, so, or just about every sentence, and so, or a, or an, or other articles. And so, if we don't take them out, then we'll fill up our index with all the pointers to the and the ands. On the other hand, because of phrases like to be or not to be, which search engines typically build in so they can make sure people can find things like that. People don't realize that, well, they think that to must be in there and not the must be in there because they show up in these phrases. So they're often surprised. Okay? If you type in vitamin A, you actually will get things about vitamin A, not about every occurrence of the letter A in the language, so that you think, well, A must be in the index. But it's not in that sense. So again, as people's model of this is just not accurate. People don't realize if you type a string boat fire, that's different than fire boat. Because this says boat fire is a fire that happened on a boat, and the fire boat's a thing that puts out those things. It's tricky. Most people are not able or haven't figured out how tricky these things are. And so the that's why you'll find that this has been this constant iteration of techniques to make user interfaces both more powerful but also easier to use. And it's, again, it's a very, very subtle thing. So again, let me talk more about specifically the three parts of the UI for search and retrieval. Marty says that the heart of the search process is an iterative cycle of query specification, inspection and interpretation, and reformulation. Three phases. You select and structure what you're going to ask for. You decide how to arrange what the results are, and you say, well, how do I tell that that's not what I want, and then sort of iterate and start over a little bit. Those are the three problems. And as I said, small details matter. But also what's implied by this is that speed is essential. If you can't do these things very, very quickly and efficiently, then you won't do them. You'll get sort of stuck, and you'll... So be able to look at this, specify, get results, evaluate, go around again effectively, efficiently is really important, which is why you have seen this kind of minimalist interface, because loading a page with a lot of graphical stuff around it would slow it down and would actually make it difficult to focus on this iterative thing. Okay, so we said that UIs matter. There really is this tension between information and clutter, and how and where you arrange information is very critical. There's a those of you who've studied psychology, especially perception, know about the Gestalt principles. There's a book by Tidwell on designing interfaces, which I really recommend, that has a nice handle on this stuff, and there's a picture I've stolen from that book, which shows these Gestalt principles of proximity, similarity, continuity, and closure. Proximity means things that should go together should be displayed together, close together. Things which are similar should have the similar kind of graphical treatment. Things which kind of have some kind of flow or chronology should be laid out to emphasize that. And the notion of continuity, things which should play out in some order should be in that order. And you can then use all these techniques, emphasizing, you know, color, organization, continuity, and so on, to have a much better display. These, you know, small details like, well, what should the space be between two parts of a result? Well, might change how you, what you focus on in the results section of a query output. That plus the fact that people are lazy, people are stupid, all the kind of other things apply to the problem of using information. People don't read information, they don't read instructions. They scan, or they get something like, well, I'm looking for it. They're not really looking very carefully at the results. You may pack a lot of information in the results query. People aren't realizing how compact the output is, and they don't get it. So this poses this challenge that we want to both provide lots of power, but we have to disclose it very carefully. Because if we put a lot of complexity in the interface, people will be overwhelmed by it. So we want to have essentially simple, it should be simple to do simple things and possible to do complicated things. That's basically the design rule. And so you want to have progressive disclosure of that complexity. Give it to you when you really need it or when you really ask for it. Don't give it to you by default.
So that's why you have the out-of-the-box experience of the search engine being typed into a little query window. And then we have lots of subtle little add-on features which try to improve that query specification activity, like more advanced capabilities if you ask for them, query suggestions, sort of query expansion and contraction, which we'll see some of, and then what we call DWIM, do what I mean, like spelling correction, where we try to sort of nudge you in the direction of having a query which is more likely to give you the results you intended. So we look at Google Advanced Search. If you go to Google and you click where it says Advanced, you get this big window which has lots of capabilities for refining your query to do more of this kind of Boolean operations that you want to have only these or these and these. You want to change the way you output the number of results per page. You want to search only in certain languages, only in certain file formats, and so on. Bing does it slightly differently. I actually think Bing's is better in the sense that Bing, when Bing does advanced queries, it does it after you've gotten some results. And so it always shows the context in which you've been searching, sort of the history of your previous queries. I typed here XML and business or something like that language, and it said, well, do you want to do them all of them or one of them? Or how do you want to reformulate that query to make it more precise? And it showed that I typed XML business here the first time. Yeah.
Okay, you mentioned earlier people are stupid, people are lazy.
I don't really mean that. I mean that. I don't want to. People are lovely. All God's children have a right to do search queries.
No, but I agree. People want the answer right away. So how is this advanced search applicable? Who really uses it or would bother?
Well, the average query, if you measure the number of words typed into a search box, is something like 2.5. So that suggests that most people don't use these advanced features. Now, the fact is, it used to be 1, and so now it's raising up. It's going from 1 to 1.5 to 2. So it's people asking more complex queries because they're getting more used to this stuff after 10 years of using it. But we're still asking very complicated things. Yes?
So in terms of XML, this would be changing PC data to view data. Specify anything you want in an advanced query to here are your enumerated options.
They're nudging you to give you more power, but they don't want to. I mean, I think that the Google goes, bam, there's an awful lot of stuff here at once. And so I think that they're both great engines, of course, but I mean Bing is really trying in this new rollout to really have very, very carefully designed UIs for search. They have some of the world's best people in search working there, like Sue Dumais, for example, who you read about, has led some of the research teams in UIs for search for about 10 years at Microsoft. And you know, every company has problems getting their research into their products, but Microsoft's finally getting it together because they realize that this is really competitive, important to them. Google's been kicking them around the street. And they got to sort of put some real energy into this so they're going to catch up. So they've started making the people in search research more important in the product divisions. One thing that's quite interesting is that most search engines do query refinement that you don't even ask for. They assume you want it. And how many Berkeleys are there?
There's lots of them. Okay? There's Berkeley County, West Virginia. There's Berkeley County, New Jersey. Berkeley Township, New Jersey. Okay? But when you type weather in Berkeley, they don't think you're asking for what the temperature is in Berkeley Township in New Jersey, because they know where you are based on things like your IP address or your previous queries and so on. And so you're getting... it's as if you're saying weather, Berkeley, and whatever your current context or location is. And most search engines are doing this now. They do it in slightly different ways. Again, this is Bing's, this is Yahoo's, this is Ask. So again, you type weather in Berkeley, they go, oh, you must be in California. Okay? And, you know, it's an open question whether you should be asked, do you really want the ones that the place you're at now, based on my guess of where you are, or should they just assume that? Right? So, a lot of iPhone apps, I always say, can I use your current location kind of thing, right? Because when you're in a mobile context, that's probably
probably what you really want. It's not clear that you want it when you're sitting at your desktop. You may be planning to go on vacation someplace. If I say weather London, and I'm sitting in Ottawa, Canada, do I want London, Ontario, or do I want London, England? Well, I may want London, England, but I'm only 50 miles from London, Ontario, so it could be confused. So again, it's very subtle. So instead, we're having localized queries without even asking you. But they must have studied query logs and said, you know, most of the time people want the localized query, so we're going to give it to them by default. Okay. Google has a very nice thing. I'm sure you've all used this, whether you have known it or not, where if you go to Google and you say, I want to get XML, I mean offline. I'm not offline. Not offline. Okay, let's go to Google. Okay, so if I type in XML here, I'm getting, so watch. Here's X. Here's XM. Here's XML. You see how the suggestions are changing, right? Because it says, I'm using some notion of what the most likely thing to follow you next is, and then you can jump down to the query you particularly like. Alright. It would probably mean, and I show a couple slides of that because I wanted, in case Mike couldn't, I want you to remember this, there's XML, and see how they changed from XML's, XM radio to all XML stuff at that point. This idea of having a way to restrict the content of your search is in most systems that do information retrieval. You go to Amazon, you can choose which category of goods you want to search in, and so on. So again, it's an important feature to be able to have this kind of query refinement. And there's a lot of ways to do it. I'm sure that Amazon has tested 100 ways to do this, just as Google and Microsoft have. And for their particular configuration of services and interface components, this seems to be the way to make it work. But I mean, the Amazon homepage has 600 services running on it. So it's, you know, everything has to sort of fight for its real estate and has to be very carefully, you know, connected with everything else around it and so on. And so I'm sure there's been an awful lot of work to make that particular pull-down menu work that way. One of the more interesting findings, again, it's not unobvious, but one way to get people to ask better queries is to give them more real estate. So if you have a window that says, here's the search window, people type queries, and if you say, so instead of saying query terms, they type terms, and if you say, tell us what your problem is, and the more you type, the more better we're going to give you, well then people will type more complex queries with more content words in them. Not surprising, but they actually get better results, and it's, maybe your mother could have told you that, if you ask me a better question, I'll give you better answers, don't be so cryptic with me, right? But, nonetheless, more real estate gives you better answers. On the other hand, what did you give up by having that real estate taken up by the bigger query box? And so again, it's this everything has to fight for its space in the user interface. My favorite example of how small UI details matter is what I think is in Marty's book. It's about where you put spelling corrections. So in the earliest versions of Google, and I think this is also true of Microsoft, you would type in some search word, and if you misspelled it, it would just use that term as is and dump a bunch of results at you. And then at the end, it would say, did you mean to type this? And people would start looking at the words, and then they'd scan down, and they would then have forgotten by the time I got to the end of the list that they'd misspelled the word. Okay? So Google decided at the end of each of the 10 queries, 10 results, to retype again their spelling suggestion. Did you mean to spell this? Okay? And they found a significantly higher proportion of people changing the query. Because now they're seeing it twice, just the top of the page and the bottom of the page. Because by the time you got to the bottom, you've seen enough results with you hadn't realized that was, in fact, this misspelling. It was like the planned pilot kind of case. You'd found some result because people had misspelled it enough, but in fact, it was wrong. So, not surprisingly, as we'll talk a bit about later this semester when we get to more natural language processing applications, any large corpus can be used as a spell checker. Because you type in the two possibilities, you think of the way to spell the words, and the one with the most hits is probably the correct one. Right? So that kind of using just the fact that you have large amounts of data, statistical properties of the queries, you know, the things that happen the most are probably the right ones. You can use that for things like translation and all kinds of things you can use based on the size of the corpus. Now, spelling correction is just a special case of this more general mechanism called do what I mean. This is one of the really tricky parts of interface design. Some of you might have tried this in your interfaces. Because what it really is doing is says, I know better than you what you meant. And people often, really, what they're really saying, they say, I don't want what I typed, I want what I meant. The fact that I'm a bad speller, I know you're smarter than me, give me what I want. Type anything you want and it'll say, no, what you really meant was this, and just do it for you. So it might automatically suggest a spelling correction, or it might automatically add to your query synonyms or related terms. If I type a low probability alias, it might give me higher probability terms sort of implicitly or with my query. But remember that little paperclip that used to pop up in Microsoft? Do you want me to do this for you now? Do you want me to refragment your disk now? Right. Defragment? Do you want me to format your disk now? Whatever it was. And he would say, no, damn it, go away. Right? So the kind of line between useful do what I mean support and nagging is like the line between targeted advertising and spam. When it works, it's great. When it doesn't work, you think it's terrible. But it's the same machine doing it, it's just that it's just crossed that line for you. So DWIM is hard. If you can do it well, great. If you can't do it well, don't try. Because it's better not to do it. Better to do it not at all than to do it badly. Okay. Then we'll talk about best practices in presenting your results. What's the average number of pages of results people look at? One. Maybe 1.1. Okay. That's why there is a science of search engine, I say science loosely, search engine optimization, because getting into the top results is critical. If you don't make that first page or two, you might as well not exist. Most people don't go past more than one or two pages. So you have the query engine will present some notion of the most relevant or ranked results, but trying to put ranks on and numbers or anything like that confuses the hell out of people. This is a 0.935 versus a 0.921, like the BCS or something like that, because you know what that means. You know, doesn't work. Just list them, and the sort of people have come to understand that the order in which they show up is your guess of how important they are. You may want to sort them based on the date. Often the most recent stuff should go first, because people are often really asking queries about give me the most relevant and current stuff. You may try to sort them according to category labels. Like remember the Flamenco where we did flat faceted classification, and we essentially organized our results according to these facets, which we automatically extracted from the descriptive part of the bibliographic record. We may want to highlight the terms that we type, so when you have the results, there may be some way of either bolding or maybe even coloring the results. You may want to show some part of the text of the original document, so you have which has the keyword, the contact word that you searched for in the middle of it, so you see some notion of the context. And again, the question, how wide should that window be? Because if you have a wide window, you have more context, but you can have fewer results on a page. So again, you're trading off context for a number of results. What's interesting is that there have been a number of attempts to visualize queries, results, and clusters or graphs and stuff. It doesn't help. There's been a huge amount of research there, and most of it has been clever, but a failure from a usability standpoint. We'll see some of that in a bit. Here you see some examples of highlighting. You could do this either in the engine or with something like GreaseMonkey, where you say, I'm going to basically take the query and I want to highlight it when it's displayed. Here you see the context where the words you typed are going to be bold-faced, right? So you typed how to prevent cheese from getting moldy, and here you see the things you're trying to be put, you know, in bold. Okay, again, to sort of show that you got it. Now, of course, that could be very confusing if you're popping up aliases, right? If you typed how to prevent, you know, Staphylococcus from coming on my, and you get mold, you say, well, I meant Staphylococcus or whatever it was, not mold, I meant this particular kind. Groupings is one of these interesting research areas where people have tried to cluster or organize the results of a query because it kind of is going to be needed. You need to do it anyway somehow to make sense of the things you've gotten to fit them into categories so you can decide which ones most closely match the context of your use. But the question there is then, are those categories ones which were pre-existed, that is, that they're essentially a part of the metadata structure of the record, where you say, someone's gone in and said, what are the categories that this document is associated with, like a Library of Congress description would have on a book, what are its keywords, and what the classification system is it in, or are those categories, in a sense, invented by some algorithm as a useful technique to organize your results. The latter, where it's done by machine, is typically called clustering rather than categorization. It's automated technique for assigning groups to results to groups. Typically, it's exclusive assignment. It obviously is more flexible than if you had predefined categories, but of course, it's only as good as the algorithm, and it is very much subject to the vocabulary problem, because it's going to cluster on the basis of the words that actually occurred most of the time. So here you see a search engine called Carrot 2, which if you haven't seen, where's Carrot 2? Carrot 2, the clustering search engine. And again, you type in a word, like we'll just pick something like, well, that Berkeley's easy, we'll do that, right? It's going to try to visualize, I forgot about this part. It's going to try to take the results that it finds to the query Berkeley and then sort of sort them into clusters. So here I have University of California cluster, UC Berkeley cluster, Berkeley City cluster, George Berkeley cluster, Berkeley County cluster, and so on. And that is not useful to you. So if I go and I want to get the University of California clusters, it shows me, I don't know, this little thing at the bottom, the little dots, something about where in the set of hits you're going to find those particular ones. Let me just, I don't know, jump here. See this? I think it looks kind of goofy. A lot of energy for not a lot of value, I think. Okay? This is one where I searched for my a site called iBoogie, which has got to be the dumbest name ever invented for a search engine. I mean, it certainly says, I'm not serious about this activity. I'm going to boogie. I guess you're surfing. I get it. My boogie board. I'm boogie boarding on the web because I'm surfing the web. It must be that someone had a bad idea when they made that company. But here you see that I suffer from the authority control problem. We know about that. It was question 6 of the midterm. All right, so here I type in Glushko and we get Glushko at Amazon.com, my homepage, the rocket guy who has the crater of the moon named after him. The crater, which I am confusing the search engine now by having a link to it on my homepage, the Glushko crater on the moon. But here you see, first two entries are Bob Glushko and Robert J. Glushko, who apparently are different people because they have different clusters, because I've been careless about having two identities on the web. So again, that clustering is clearly only as good as the data. As opposed to categories where someone has said, there's a fixed set of bins, and either we put things into those bins by hand or by machine, but because it's a fixed set, you are not going to have as many kind of weird categories
where we might have here, I get document, Glushko of Berkeley, Glushko Samuelson, Rocket Systems, Valentin, Glushko Board. I'm on the Oasis board, and that's somehow coming up as a category of things for me. Space, service design, standards, technology, Soviet, Ukraine. I mean, kind of a weird set of things, but it shows that there's a kind of pattern, just statistical pattern of results. So this idea of fixed categories may be a little bit better. And in this case, you see an example of Google where we type vitamin A, and it's trying to say, well, we have things organized under drug uses, side effects, interactions, warnings for patients, for health professionals, and for medical authorities. So those are a much more, perhaps, sensible set of categories to look for further results. But then you have the question, well, were they classified correctly? Especially since you probably have the one and only one place thing going on here now. We've seen in the Hurst et al. Paper, or the Yee et al. Paper, the Flamenco thing, again, where we're presenting results according to the facets as the categorization buckets. So remember, we extracted from the Hurst collection media type, location, date, themes, objects, nature, and so on. And now we're going to use these. Essentially, this is a cluster, a categorization of the results of this query to that point. And again, the best practices seem to be saying, you know, context is really critical. Try to maintain the context of the search somehow with text that shows what sentence or paragraph that the search terms appeared in. Highlight them in some way. Make it easy to see, so you can make it easy to see, so you can then see quickly the impact on the results of changing the context or adding to it. Many people have tried to get relevance feedback where you say, give me more like this. But again, a big question there is, what is the scope of like this? So if I have a set of results and I say, here's 10 of the results, and I say, I like this particular item, do I then... I want to somehow refine the query by using the words that appear in that item as part of the implied or augmented query. But then the question is, how much of it do I use? If it's a small Wikipedia article, that's one thing. But if it's like part of a book, well, how much of the book do I use to generate possible keyword terms and things like that, right? So you get the idea what I'm trying to get at? Again, I'm saying let's go back to here. So if I have a result like this, just hypothetically, and I say, you know, I really want things like this. So I somehow indicate that this should be, let's find me more like this. And some of them even say, find more like this one. I can click one and say, find more like this. But then the question is, well, is it just this text here or the whole paragraph or the whole page, things like that? Because what you're really saying is, somehow take terms that are in that particular output and make it part of the new query. So again, it sounds easy to do in principle to say get more like this, but exactly what that means is often hard to implement. And again, the question there is, if people could say this is a really good result, so next time you display this query, get more like this, that would be great, but the problem is most people will not rate things if you make it explicit. You won't say, take the time now and rate the output of this query. They go, I'm got to move on. That's not what I'm not here to rate. I'm here to use. So if you do it implicitly by saying, well, which ones do people actually follow, right? So the search engines know when you have results, which ones got clicked through. That's obviously a good indicator that was actually what you intended to find when you did that query. And then that becomes, let's kind of bump up that one with respect to those search terms. So you can imagine very complicated data being collected that's being used in very subtle ways to improve the precision of a query. But because that's implicit, it's you know, you don't really know what the context was in which people were following that item. They may thought, this is a dumb looking one. I'm going to see what it says. What a dumb set of words in this query. So I think it may be that it's the worst one. That people are following it because it's somehow clever. And that's really the case when you have non-text media, that what people follow is often like the weird one rather than the most representative or the most useful one. So being able to somehow get people to vote on them is important. And that's why you're seeing some of these like social techniques or games even being used as a way to improve the precision of the search term. So the games like the Louis von Ahn's set of games at Carnegie Mellon, where he's like where you have two people are given an object and told to try to guess the name that the other person is using for it. That's kind of a way to have a game to refine the metadata or the best descriptor for that object. So that kind of game is typical of this challenging activity to get explicit relevance feedback. Okay, now I'm going to go back and show you the most important 7 slides. Okay, I wrote them down here, so I can go to my very powerful table of contents thing here and click through them. Pretty cool, huh? Do that in PowerPoint. All right. So we'll start with this slide where I talked about the classical IR system and the U I had implied. Again, this showed that because we had it was a scarce resource, we had to provide restricted access to it, you had to be highly trained. That implies a very powerful, very cryptic command language, and you see the results of that. So as a result, query specification really is this black art with a very powerful set of operators that are very, very cryptic, like the fact that this says use format 3, which means some subset of the metadata. I want to only get the titles and the first paragraph of these resources, or the title and the author, or the bibliographic citation, or whatever it is. And this says how many you want to print out at one time. Again, this is immense and precise control over the output, but it requires a priest or priestess of information retrieval to use. So we can improve that with an interface by webifying and using more modern interface design practices, but the interface is really dictated by the complexity of the underlying problem with these specialized resources, and no amount of clever UI is going to make the hard problem become easier. It's still going to be a hard problem because you've got this, requires a great amount of domain knowledge to know what you should be looking for. I have to figure out which of the, I mean, do even you, any of you even know how the court systems are organized in this country? You've got, you know, state courts, federal courts, hierarchy of the federal court system, the district courts, the circuit courts, the Supreme Court, the federal court for patents and so on and so on. Which of those resources do you look for? Requires a great amount of knowledge to know how to, even what to use, let alone how to actually invoke the functionality in the user interface. Okay. Oh. That's not what I would have said. I would have said this one. Sorry, I meant this one. 22, not 21. Fix that. So this is the canonical way of thinking about user interfaces for IR, that there's three kinds of problems you have to address: how you specify the query, how you present the results of the query, and how you enable people to refine or reformulate their query when they decide that the results may not have been exactly what they wanted. And again, the best practices here are to progressively disclose this great power you want to provide to people. You saw the differences in the advanced queries of Microsoft, Bing, and Google. Find ways to suggest queries. Some of it will be done in hidden ways, like where you are doing expansion and contraction based on the number of results you'd like to present. If you think you're going to have too few results for the user, you may want to, in fact, do some ORing with other synonyms or aliases. If you have too many, you want to do some ANDing and restrict what you show the user, because they're going to have too many hits to overwhelm them. Do what I mean, but do it in a very judicious way. When you present results, again, there's best practices, but again, these are always difficult to apply in any particular configuration. But obviously, you present ranked results, you sort them somehow, you give people the ability to sort, maybe by recency or by authors or by source or something like that. You try to group them somehow. And typically, it's better to sort according to well-defined labels than to generate the labels by some amount of text processing. You want to highlight the query terms, provide some context around them, but don't try to visualize them because that confuses people. And finally, the best practices in results, query reformulation, is that you want to make it easy to provide iterative search. Primarily, that means make it fast. And find it some easy way to say, in the current context, add or subtract terms. And if you're lucky, you can find a way to get relevance feedback in a way which isn't obtrusive. Yes? Only 10 years. No, well, the practices, more or less, the guidance of this level of abstraction is considered to be conventional wisdom. Now, of course, everything is in the details. So companies like Google or Yahoo or Microsoft are conducting experiments every single day, where if you work for those companies and you are in UI for IR, maybe I should maybe invite some of those students back here who are alums, okay? They're doing experiments where they'll say, you know, maybe if we had a line between the title of the hit and then the context, so you kind of box it so you see that this is the query in context. Maybe put a box around that that's 5 pixels wide, people will focus on it better. So let's put every 1,000th result, we'll do that. And we'll see if that small change from one randomly selected 1,000th of every searcher's causes greater click-through. They do that for a week and they say, you know what, it doesn't matter, we won't do that. Well, it does matter. Let's try putting boxes. Well, how many pixels should that box be? Let's try 5, let's try 7, let's try 9. Happening all the time. You don't know whether you're in an experiment when you go to Google, but you may be in an experimental condition. It's sort of continuous research and usability. But it doesn't well map to the traditional ways of teaching, going to the laboratory. It's done in vivo in this really kind of continuous way. Okay. Well, how'd that work? A little review? Okay. So, for next time, we're moving now into a new kind of lecture. Up to now, we've had qualitative reading, at times even literary. We've read things like, you know, Borges, right? No more Borges. From here on, it's going to be much narrower as we focus more on kind of computer science-y kind of topics. And we'll start with 2 chapters from the Manning et al. Book. The first 2 guys are professors at Stanford, I think, computer science. And their first 2 chapters are information retrieval using the Boolean model and essentially how text processing works. And as I said, I'm going to start ask my TAs to look at upcoming lectures very carefully to try to winnow down as much as possible the reading, saying, this is the most important 5 pages, then these 2 pages are skimmable, right? Because I want to make it as crisp as possible, but no crisper. And that'll be the challenge over the next month or so as we wrap up the semester over the last, you know, 10 lectures or so. With that, I think we have some exams to pass out. Have you put the grades on them? Okay, so I will send out the mapping to that grade. If you're not happy with the grade, what you have to do, the first thing you can do is not talk to me, but to look at the sample exam, which is posted.
Will be after this. After
it'll be posted soon. Okay. Read the sample questions and look at the sample answers and talk to your TA. Talk to me. The purpose of the exam is to give you a sense of whether you were tracking the course at the right level. And I said I was pleasantly surprised for some of you and unpleasantly surprised for some of you. And I will talk to both of those sets. All right. Talk to you Wednesday.